So I'm a professor in computer science at the Université Paris Sud, and I've been here for my entire career. As researchers and teachers, it's good, mobility is good, because that's how we exchange ideas. So even though I spent my whole career here, I've also moved. I spent first year in 1992, where I went to Canada, the United States, and England in different research centers, including University of Toronto, Xerox PARC at the time, and Rank Xerox EuroPARC, which doesn't exist anymore, and also a lab in Paris. Then in 98 to 2000, I would spend 2 years in Denmark, in the University of Aarhus. And the last 2 years, I was in the US again. I spent 2 years at the University of Stanford. And that's one of the things that convinced me that we should have more of these international programs. And so I've learned a lot by seeing how teaching is done in these different places, and tried to import some of this here. So this class has, in fact, two different names in the two different programs. For the interaction masters, it's called Fundamentals for Human-Computer Interaction, and for the CID master is called Introduction. Don't be mistaken, it's the same thing. Fundamentals sounds more serious, but it's really the same content. First question, I'm going to have you participate. So, first question, who has already taken a class that was HCI? Okay, so now for those who've answered, what was it about? I'll start at the back there.
I took one introduction course in human-computer interaction design and one evaluation methods course. And my bachelor thesis was also about.
Okay, so you are the expert already.
No.
Well, I guarantee you that the, well, we'll ask you at the end of the course, but I'm sure the overlap between my intro course and the one you took and someone else's are going to be maybe 20%. So we'll see. Who was next in the back? Yes?
For me, it was something I came like, we had some theoretical parts, some practice parts, and some evaluation of the project that we did. So it's more fundamental.
Okay. It's alright. So, you're next.
Yeah, so I took this introduction course in ETS, and like, it was more based towards the research that was going on at ETH. It's like around like pen paper interaction and like web based usabilities, like multi touch and stuff like that.
Right.
And like, I mean, it's just an overall idea about everything, like haptics, virtual reality. And stuff.
Right. So it was an intro course, but it was about their research.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was next? I think you were next, yes?
Yeah, I had like a fundamental course mostly about UI design and evaluation of those UIs. And so it's more a practical approach than the theory behind it.
Okay, and so these things you'll see in what we have in programming of interactive systems and... you're in the...
I'm in the ontology.
Yes. Yeah, so you'll get some of this, but by yourself.
Yeah.
So you already did it. Yeah, we don't focus too much on the programming part. We think when you reach the master's level, you know how to program, you can open the user manual, and so we'll give you principles, but then it's up to you. I think you were next.
Yes. It was more about the history of GUIs and how it developed through the years. It was an evaluation part of a site that we have to say whenever anything is wrong or right on that side.
And how many percentage of the time is wrong?
Most of it. we evaluated the Greek post office site. It was really easy.
Yeah.
It has all the wrong things.
Exactly. His website is the example of what not to do.
Yeah.
So. then I had people in the front row here. Yes?
Yeah, I had one in Munich. Professor Butz, and in the class we had like history of different UIs, some landmarks, and in the practical exercises we used like user research methods and had to develop a project.
Okay, that's good. Was there anybody else? So the thing is, human-computer interaction is a very wide field. And it's a field because it is multidisciplinary. Depending on where you go, you get people who teach more the technical aspect of it, or more the psychological, the human psychology part, or ergonomics, or other aspects, or design, etc. And it's really hard to do an intro class like this, because you have to decide all the things you're not going to talk about. And so oftentimes you end up talking about the stuff you know best, because it's, well, first it's easier, but it's also, I think, more interesting for students if you talk about things you know about. So in this class, I've made a choice. In the introduction class today, it's going to be about, a lot is going to be about the historical perspective, and of course, covering the history of HCI in an hour and a half is a little bit silly, so I will pick some things that I think are important. Then there's what I call Psychology 101, about the basics of what the human performance is in terms of motor skills, sensory skills, and cognitive skills. Then I will focus on graphical interaction, because that's what we're using all the time nowadays, so try to dig a bit into that. I will have one class on the engineering, just to explain that the tools and the languages we have are completely unfit to programming interfaces, which is why it's so hard and why interfaces suck. Then I'll do a more researchy class on giving you an overview of what I call, and a number of people call, post-WIMP interaction. So graphical interaction is often called WIMP. I'll explain that. So what we call post-WIMP is what is coming next. And then the last part here is more on the design side, so conceptual design, how we go about designing a system from identifying a problem to creating a solution. Now again, this is not going to be covered in one class, so we'll focus on one key thing, which is the notion of a conceptual model. And then I'll give you an overview of a number of theories and models that are relevant to human-computer interaction, looking at those that come from computer science, such as software engineering, those that come from psychology, and those that are really proper to human-computer interaction. And in the end, so either this will take two classes, but I'll try to sneak some part on groupware and cooperative systems and social, what's called nowadays social computing. For those of you in the interaction masters, there's an elective on this, but not everybody will take it. And for the other group, you don't have a specific class on this, so I would like to talk a little bit about this, because it's an important aspect of interactive computation nowadays. So, human-computer interaction, what is it? Well, the way I look at it is very simple, is that you have human, computer, and interaction. It seems simple. The thing that I want to emphasize here is when you talk about human-computer interaction, people hear user interfaces. In this country, in France, for 20 years now, I've tried to have people talk about, in French, the acronym is IHM, I-H-M, human-computer interaction, instead of user interfaces. And I still not won the battle. Many places, people say, oh, you're doing user interfaces. So I'll get to that in a minute. So what are we doing? We have computers. We all know computers. I think if you're here, you like computers. Yeah? I mean, there are people who are in HCI who hate computers. That's why they try to fix the problem. So if you take the course that Wendy will give, she'll tell you that she got into HCI because she hates computers. But we know computers have certain capabilities. They are able to compute, to store things, to have some primitive input and output. And they are very good at dumb things, and not so good at things we think are intelligent. On the other side, we have humans. We all know humans. We're all humans. We know we're weird. We have some capabilities for action, physical action. We're very able with our hands. Perception. Vision is a dominant sense, but as we will see, the what we call touch and tactile sense is very developed as well and important. And we have cognitive abilities. Now, why did we come about invent computers? You know why computers were created in the first place? You know when they were created?
To simplify the job of humans?
Yes. So that's the role of technology in general. Why do we have technology? It's to make our lives easier, more comfortable, and have a number of things that can be taken care of without, you know, having every day to go out and kill some animals to have some food. So a lot of the technology has been created to either externalize our capabilities or in general, in a second wave, augment them. A lot of this has been done by creating tools and instruments and machines. So if you think of the Industrial Revolution, the Industrial Revolution came about when we found a way to have external sources of power, of energy, mastered in some way, so we could put them to do things like lifting heavy stuff. And it went from having the lifting done by the machine instead of humans to having machines lift stuff that no human could lift. So you have this externalization process, I have something else do it for me, and then this augmentation, this something else does it better in some sense. Now this is fairly obvious if you look at the Industrial Revolution and machines, but you have the same thing with writing. What was happening before writing was invented?
It was difficult to communicate an idea through a lot of people.
Yes.
You have noise between what I say and you say to she, I don't know.
Okay.
And also it's a time factor.
So it was inefficient in that there was noise, it was time consuming. What was it consuming also? If you don't have a way to write things,
you have to tell the same thing over and over again.
Yes, so oral traditions, you have to tell things over and over again, which means they have to be in your head.
Yeah.
Now, we have a big brain, right? We have a big memory, but still, the fact that everything had to be remembered uses cognitive abilities. And so, if you look at the invention of writing, and then later the printing press, it allowed to externalize a lot of things that then were on paper you didn't have to remember. You don't have to learn the phone book. It's on paper, and now it's on the computer. Right? And if you read some philosophers, some recent philosophers, they explain that by externalizing some of these cognitive abilities, such as storing information into books, it made room for developing other abilities. And so the computer is just one more step in that progression. We can externalize more things into the computer. Before Google, when you had to look for something, it was painful. Do you remember life before Google? No, that's sad. That's sad because you don't realize what it was like. And so, life before Google. I mean, imagine the things you did to come to take this master's. To find about it, to register, to do all the paperwork, to do everything, if you didn't have not only the all the tools, but just a search engine. But now think of something else, think of the GPS. Right? So before the GPS, what did we use?
Maps.
Yeah.
Traditional maps.
Only maps?
And before the stars.
No memory.
Yes, you had to know where you go. You had to plan the trip on paper. Then you would get lost, and it would be up to yourself to figure out where you were, and these kind of things. However, by doing this, you develop also mental maps. So you would know, if you think of a taxi driver doesn't need to look at the map. He knows where things are by practicing driving every day. Now, with a GPS, I use a GPS, and now I don't even know where I am, where I go somewhere. You know, you punch in the thing, and the machine tells you where to go. And you don't know if it's the best route or the nicest one. You know you're going to get there. So I've externalized the ability to pick my route myself, and I can do other things. I can pay more attention to, you know, the scenery or chatting with people in the car. But it also means that I've lost something, which is I don't know really where I am. And if the GPS runs out, battery or something, stops working, I'm really lost. So my point here is to emphasize that what we're doing with technology in general, with computers in particular, is this constant balance of things, where there are things we like to do ourselves and stay in control of. There are things we like to have others, other people or machines do for ourselves, but when we externalize these things, we lose some control. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But coming back to that diagram here, the other thing to look at is the fact that the capabilities of humans and computers are very different. We are not very good at computing, per se. You know, we're not very good at doing math in our head. We're not very good at storage. Human memory is fascinating, but sometimes it's not good at remembering exact things. An input and output is pretty limited for humans. We can do things with our hand, and we can speak. Input and output on the computer, I would say, is even more limited, but computation and storage is much more developed. Our abilities for action and perception are very acute. I will talk about this in the next class. We don't have a vision system in the computer that comes close to what the human eye can do, although there are things the computer can do with vision that human eyes cannot do, but many obvious things the computer cannot do. Even worse for action. Have you ever seen a robot wash the dishes or fold the laundry or do something useful? Not really, because it's the action part is difficult. And of course, cognition is something that artificial intelligence has tried for a long time to replicate into computers. But again, there are some things it's very good at, and some things that seem very obvious for us that it's very poor at doing. So we have these two things that we try to speak to each other and use each other, and that's what interaction is about. But they are very different in terms of their capabilities. And so interaction is really a phenomenon that you could observe. If I take someone, sit that person in front of the computer, and I observe, what I observe is interaction. And our goal is that we want to control this phenomenon. We want to control it so that, in general, users can do things they couldn't do before. And we also want to use it so that computers can do things they couldn't do before. Now, when I say we control the phenomenon, how can we control it? What can we change in the system? Can I change the human, or can I change the computer?
Computer and maybe the environment?
Yes, I didn't get to the environment yet, but yes. Changing the user, I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm fine the way I am. There are some people who do implants and crazy things. Maybe it will happen, but personally I prefer to leave humans evolve by themselves, and they do evolve, because when you put them in the environment, they learn, they develop skills. And we'll talk about this notion of co-adaptation, where humans adapt to technology. Once I give you, you know, search engine, you adapt to it, but it also changes you. So you change it, and it changes you. So the main thing we can change really is the computer. So we can create new computers, new programs. And that's why people often identify human-computer interaction with developing user interfaces. But interaction is a phenomenon. User interface is the means by which you can control this phenomenon. And I think it's important to make this distinction. Now, the last piece here is this doesn't happen in the void. It happens in an environment. A physical environment, are you sitting at a desk or are you out there in the wild? The social environment, are you at home or at work? What kind of work? Organizational, cultural, etc. And of course, these environments affect the number of aspects of the humans, which in turn affect aspects of the computer. I realized that I didn't give you the slides. That's a good thing. So, but now it's time. So I copied the slides I'm going to show today. I will not do that every class. I hope you have, actually it's a good question. Do you have access to computers in the building here, or how does this work? You have no idea. Okay, well, I will find out for you. For the master two, I think master two it should be in building 650. Okay.
But you have an account which
okay.
Login, but I haven't found any computer
rule. Okay, well, I can find out for you. And maybe I'll copy the slides again next week. But after that, it'll be up to you to find printers.
Are there printers?
Oh, yeah.
Are these things on the website as well? Like, are they available?
They will be available, and of course, I'll make them available before class, so you can print them before rather than after. But I finished those slides yesterday night, so. Now, this nice picture of the user, the computer, and the interaction in between is a nice theoretical picture. In reality, things are more complicated. Well, first, we interact with more and more devices. So, how many of you have a laptop? Okay, it's a pretty good proportion. How many of you has a what we call a smartphone, a phone that does more than a phone? Okay. So, I could ask with tablets, with a desktop and the laptop, but it doesn't matter. We know that we have more and more devices. It's also rare that although the usage of computers is mostly personal these days, computers are used for tasks that requires groups of people to work together. So you really are involved in a number of relationships with other people to carry the task that also requires computers. So that's where all the group aspect comes in, what is called computer cooperative, computer-supported cooperative work, CSCW, terrible acronym. These days, people call that social computing, and it includes social networks and a number of other things that I'll try to cover this towards the end. We also don't interact only with computers. So here, you are taking notes, hopefully, on paper with a pen. So how many of you are going to take these handwritten notes and put them into a computer? No? Yes? One? Yeah, maybe? Okay. So why is that? Why are you all have a laptop. Some of you brought it. But why are you taking notes on paper?
It's faster.
It's faster.
We are used to it.
You're used to it?
And if you want to make a draw, it's easier.
You can draw more easily?
And also because it's the first thing that you learn, how to learn.
Yeah.
Writing and reading, it is right.
For how long?
How long?
Yeah.
20 years.
Well, do you think your kids will learn to type before they learn to...
Probably.
You think so? It's interesting, we had a discussion recently about this, and I said, I hope not. These computers are still so poor.
So I was already using headphones before, and I'm not too right. Already, it doesn't go.
Yeah, there are kids who know how to use an iPhone before they can write.
Okay.
Does this mean they don't need to learn to write?
No.
Okay, so we'll see how many generations it will take. Did you learn to touch type at school?
Yes.
Okay, who did? Yeah? So you are from Argentina?
Yeah.
You are from?
Finland.
Oh yeah, but you're way too technological. That's the way we perceive things.
It's funny because they told us how to properly type when I was like 17 years old.
Yeah,
I used computers since I was 5.
Okay, but you know, in France, we don't teach school people to type. My own kids, they don't touch type. And that's also a big thing, that you know, if you don't touch type, there are things that you'll find paper more convenient for if you are fast. If you can touch type, you know, the trade-off start changing.
And also, in our lectures in Finland, no one writes on paper. Everybody has
really?
Their laptops. Yeah.
Yeah. But you brought a nice...
That's
why you escaped Finland?
Also, in Italy, it was forbidden to have laptops on the...
Oh, interesting.
So, just be sure.
Okay. I don't mind. Whatever works for you, I'm fine. But, you know, the point is that we are used to combining this computer stuff and non-computer stuff and spending a lot of our energy transferring things from one medium to the other. You know, these slides were made on the computer. I printed them, I made annotations, then I modified the slides, then I print them, then I give it to you, then you annotate them. And maybe, you know, if I gave you the PDFs for the file, you would annotate them on the computer. So interaction is really rich because it's not just what's going on with the computer that is interesting. And whenever you are going to design a new system, you know, the first question to ask yourself is the computer going to help? You know, what is there that are physical objects that work well enough that maybe they don't need to be replaced? Or maybe instead of replacing them with a computer, maybe we can enhance those objects with computer capabilities. So if you think of what we call tangible computing and augmented reality, and I'll say a bit more later about this, this is what it is about. It's to say, you know, there is this apparent division between the world of computers and the rest of physical objects, but these things are starting to merge more and more. Mobile devices is kind of an example, but not necessarily the best one. We'll see other examples where physical artifacts, including paper, can be turned into computers or have computing capabilities. So now I want to go a little bit deeper into what is an interactive system. So notice that I will hopefully never use the word user interface. If I use it, it will have a very specific meaning. The user interface is the part of the interactive system that is really the interface between the user and the system, so what is on the screen. So I try to use the word interactive system to talk about a computer system that is designed to interact with humans. And there is, for me, a life-changing paper, maybe it won't change your life, but it doesn't matter, by Peter Wagner, and the link will be on the, or is maybe already on the webpage. That is, he wrote in 1992, called Interaction is More Powerful Than Algorithm. Algorithms, actually, I think they're less. As I said, I did all my career here at LRI. And I literally started human-computer interaction in this lab. When I arrived, there was nobody working in that topic. I didn't even know myself it existed. I just was put in front of a computer that had the beautiful graphics screen. Nobody else knew what to do with it. And they told me, if you can do something interesting, you can stay. And so I grew up as a researcher in an environment where I was the guy doing the funny things on screens, And everybody else in the lab were doing real research, you know, graph theory, abstract specifications, distributed systems, and all that. And I was always feeling like the chip on the shoulder, you know. They like me because I can give demos when they have visitors, but they don't really think what I do is important. And then I ran into this paper, and the title, you know, attracted my attention. Interaction is more powerful than what all these other people are doing. Now, Peter Wagner is someone who has done a lot of work in object-oriented programming and in theoretical work. And his point in there is not talking, I don't think he's talking at all about human-computer interaction. He's talking about if you have multiple systems, computer systems, that talk to each other, but that are really independent from each other, they don't know much about each other, the fact that this system interact together allows you to do things that are more powerful than just an algorithm that reads input, then closes its ears, computes, and then suddenly at the end spits out the result. If you have interactive processes that, as they process data, can also take input and produce output, then you get something more powerful. And in the article, he says that, in fact, what he calls interactive machines are more powerful than Turing machines. Now, if you go say that to a guy, you know, doing algorithms, you know, either he's going to kick you out of the door or he's going to have a very interesting chat with you. Now, some people have challenged what Wagner says in terms of the power of these machines. But he has one very telling example. So imagine two machines that play chess against each other. So, you know, this is a very decoupled system. All you need to know is the state of the game. One machine says, well, I'll play this. Then the other machine computes and say, I'll play that. Now, it says, you know, if I take a very simple machine, you call it the identity machine, that shows the state of the game to a human player, the human player plays, and then the machine just replicates the move. This machine, at the time in 92, that was before Deep Blue and this whole other thing where the computer, quote, defeated the best player in the world, which was completely rigged, by the way, but anyway. So this identity interaction machine just copies human input and put it into the system, means that any other computer program would be beaten by a very good human player. And so the idea is that an interaction machine can harness, the way he says it, is it harnesses the power of in the environment. It can use stuff that it cannot do itself, like play very good chess, but use the input from a human user to become a very good chess player. So in Wagner's term, the power of interaction is that if there is something you cannot do, you can delegate it or take input from something else. And that's why interaction is more powerful. And I've always looked at interaction in this way, that what is interesting there is that you have these two entities, the human and the computer, and you try to make more than the sum of the parts. So, an interactive system is a system that holds an internal state. I'm talking here in more computer terms, computer science terms, holds an internal state. A part of this state is made visible, perceivable, can be through visual display, auditory display, tactile feedback, you name it. Not all of the state is visible, which can be a problem, but at least part of the state is visible. But the most important thing in being reactive is to react. So when there's input, the system handles that input immediately, as soon as possible, changes its internal state, and displays the new representation of the part that is displayed. So this is an interaction machine, but in the context of human-computer interaction, where input comes from the user. Now, why did I say the chest. So you know this deep blue. This deep blue saved in Japan. Yes.
Not by the name, but I heard that there
was. Okay. So I think it was in the late 90s that IBM put together a computer called Deep Blue that was able to beat Kasparov, who was at the time considered the best player who was alive. In fact, the best alive player was probably Bobby Fischer, but it's kind of disappeared. So there was a match that was organized between Kasparov and Deep Blue, and Deep Blue won. Well, it didn't win by a large margin, but it didn't win alone. Because in between each game, and I think even during the games, you had an army of programmers in the back that were tweaking the program, that studied how Kasparov played that game, and said, oh, for the next one, we're going to do this. So Kasparov lost against a computer and an army of programmers. So that's why I said it was rigged. But if anything, it illustrates exactly the point I was making, is that the computer alone, you know, was not good enough, so they added the capabilities of those human programmers to help the computer. They were harnessing their power by building an interaction machine as an opponent to the human. Okay?
So was it especially trained for this?
It was very, very trained. For
one person, so yes. It could probably not win against another.
Exactly. So, now, the thing is, to me, the point of, you know, beating humans at chess, I don't see the point of this. I mean, I don't see the point in making computers to do the exact same thing that we enjoy doing. I think people who play chess, you know, their goal is not to be done with the game as quick as possible and do something else. It's not like washing the dishes, right? They play chess because they enjoy playing chess. Now, having good computer chess players is interesting because to play chess, you need two people. And if you don't have someone else to play against, or if you play against someone who is not at your level, it's not interesting. Whether the other person is too good or not good enough for you, it's boring if you win all the time or lose all the time. Although if you lose, you learn. So having, you know, good computer programs is good, but having the best computer program capable of beating everybody, it's kind of, I don't know. I'd rather make computers that help me do things that I wouldn't be able to do otherwise, and make me a better person, and make more interesting things. And I think in this class, I will probably often get at artificial intelligence, because a lot of the program of artificial intelligence has been to beat humans at doing this or that or this other thing. And I think it has value if it helps us understand how humans work. Although I don't think the way Deep Blue beats a chess player tells us anything about how a human player actually plays. But you can make an argument that by trying to replicate human capabilities, you learn some things. But the eventual goal of AI was for a long time to replace humans. Now a number of people are thinking differently about AI, and in fact the A in AI, a lot of people now say it's more augmenting intelligence than artificial intelligence. So we're getting into this interactive paradigm I was talking about. But there are still a lot of people in AI that say, well, we want to solve this problem so we can get rid of humans altogether. And I don't find this interesting for a lot of tasks. There are a number of tasks for which it is interesting. So, properties of interactive systems. What distinguishes interactive systems from other computer systems is that they are reactive and they are what I call open. I don't have a better word. So reactive is what I was just talking about. You give input to the system and the system reacts to it, processes it immediately, and generates output that you, standing for the user, will perceive. So you push a button, you want something to happen as you push the button. Now the system is in an open, I should have the open loop here rather than just open. The system is really an open loop because obviously what the system displays to you affects what you're going to do next. You enter a query into Google, you don't know what's going to come out, or you do. Actually, oftentimes I search for things, I know exactly what answer I want in Google, right? So anyway, one way or the other, I enter something in Google, I get a response. And then my next action is usually to click on the link.
Or change the query.
Or change the query if I don't get the result I want. But from the system's perspective, the system has no way to know if what it is I'm going to do next. So it's an open loop in that way, in that sense, in that the system cannot anticipate what is my future input. This is a lot less true if you think of the protocol between computers. If you think the way your browser is speaking to the web server, this is a lot more predictable. So much predictable that, in fact, you can do predictive fetching and things like this. So what's interesting in an interactive system is that this loop is open. Neither party knows exactly what the other is going to do in response to input. Sometimes, however, it is kind of asymmetric because in terms of reactivity, as a user, I want the system to react immediately as I do something, but I don't feel like I have to react immediately to what the system does. I don't want to be slave to the machine, right? So there is asymmetry in the reactive aspect in that the user does not have to react immediately. Although, have you ever run into a situation where you want to provide input to the system before it's given you the output?
Are you talking about the scenario where a system is inefficient? Or?
Maybe it's slow. I mean, I'm sure that when you go through the menus of an application, you know very well, you can move to the item in the menu before it even shows up.
When your next action doesn't depend on the result, you may want to start it before.
Yes, sometimes I know what I want to do, and I don't care what the system is spitting back at me. I know I want to fill out the four forms and four fields and then do things like this. So, you know, what's interesting is that sometimes this loop is not even a loop. I anticipate the response, or I don't care about the response, I want to provide more input. But there's still an asymmetry in that the user wants to have the feeling that he is in control. And the other asymmetry is that the user likes to know that the system is predictable. You know, I hate doing twice the same thing and having two different results. Because we are used in the real world that the same actions have the same effects. So it's kind of wired in our brain. And if I do things twice and the result is different, which is often the case because I don't see all of the state of the system. So the system is hiding some state from me, meaning I cannot know exactly what it's going to do. Do you all know the VI text editor? Yes?
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, so VI, you know, if you are using VI and then you go away, have a coffee, and then I sneak into your computer, I can do things. When you come back, you don't know if typing D is going to delete a character or insert the D. So it's just that part of the state, which mode you're in, is not visible to you, right? So that's one reason why systems are unpredictable. The other reason why systems become unpredictable is because they try to do like us humans, they try to learn. So, you know, if we all do the same query on Google at the same time, I guarantee you we're going to get different results. Are you aware of that? Yes? Yeah, but you're geeks, so I mean... do your parents know that?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was wondering about the last point you said. Like, I mean, the way we interact with, like, the computers, like, for example, humans interact one time and they expect the same result again, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, like, more of a human behavior, maybe, because, like, I mean, you expect the same thing in a physical world, too, not just with the systems. So I was wondering, maybe this is a property of the, like, humans?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, we humans are wired for certain properties because there are constants in our environment. And when we talk about the human part next week, and again later in the theory part, I'll talk about the ecological perception theory by James Gibson, which is really about that. Things we take for granted because they are part of our environment, of, you know, the laws of physics. So that's why when you have systems that try to be more clever than you by anticipating what you're going to do, it's either magic if it guesses right, or very frustrating if it does it wrong. So there is a trade-off here. Are you taking the risk of pissing off the user, knowing that some of the times you'll get it right and the user will be very happy? Or are you making a system that is predictable, that the user can learn to use to its best advantage? As usual, there is no clear-cut answer to this. You know, in some cases, you want to do the taking the bet and helping the user by guessing, trying to guess. But more often than not, this doesn't work. I mean, there's a famous example of Clippy in Microsoft. It's trying to help you and it's always wrong. But it gets very annoying. It gets very annoying. And to do something that works, it's extremely hard. If you've ever used Siri on the iPhone, when you've seen all these ads where it's magic, and then you try it and it does silly things. So it is very, very tricky thing to do. I think it's a good area for research. It's one of the areas where artificial intelligence and human-computer interaction can do very clever things together. But right now, we're not there yet. What worries me, however, is because these learning systems, there's machine learning everywhere these days. Because these learning systems become ubiquitous, they are everywhere, we don't see them. For example, again, going back to Google, the fact that when I type something, I get the completion. The system, you know, lists what the most frequent queries are that start with these words. It changes my query. Sometimes, you know, I go for what's suggested, even though it's not what I was looking for. Just out of curiosity, or laziness, or just not paying attention. And so you have this in something as important as a search engine. You have it, all the recommender systems that you have on Amazon or something. I mean, the other day I was looking for a cable, a video cable for my son's computer. The next day I get in my mail a recommendation for buying the computer. It is scary because it means that the computer systems are really shaping us, and we lose control, but we don't realize it. There are so many web pages out there that, you know, whatever Google has decided were the top 10, you know, it will affect what you pick, and you won't realize that there are other interesting things. So I think hiding all this learning aspect is really an issue for today's system. There are other issues we'll come to, but we're getting far away from this. Now, in terms of this aspect of reactivity, the important point here is systems have to be tuned to human time constants. We are, as humans, are used to something being perceived as instantaneous if it occurs within a tenth of a second. If it's more than 1 second, it starts looking slow. If it's more than five, it's like forever. However, this is relative. Depending on how hard you think the task is, your scale will change. So you need to adapt this in the system to your knowledge of human users. Okay, I'm going to move on because I can spend the morning on this. And I think that's the last high-level thing here. Now, the way I was presenting the system was trying to show their symmetry, that they are reactive, both systems can be reactive, and both systems don't have to know what the other is exactly going to do. When you look at the literature, you read a lot of things about the human in the loop. And that's often seen as a good thing. We've put a human in the loop. We've humanized the system. Now, if you look in more detail, this is not what they're talking about. When you look at human in the loop, it's people who do aviation stuff, and they still have to have pilots in the cockpits, and they still have to have people doing air traffic control, and they have to have humans in the loop, but really, if they could get rid of it, they'd be much happier, because humans are unreliable to do planned activities. They don't follow the rules. The air traffic controllers, if they followed the rules, they couldn't have half of the planes they have in the sky, literally. They have to break the rules to handle the traffic they're given. So when you read human in the loop, you should have a blinking light in your brain going on saying, Most often it's a system-centric view where the user must conform to the system rules. So the system is really like another computer, except we didn't have time to replace it with a computer yet. So it's supposed to provide input in a specific order, in a specific format. It's supposed to do things in a certain way. And in reality, it doesn't go this way. But people who design the systems like to think that this would be the ideal. And that works for operational tasks and is often applied to situations where the user performs actions that the computer cannot yet do. And what I would like to say is that I want to see a system where it's more the computer-in-the-loop approach, which is a more human-centric view. If you've taken an HCI class before, you must have heard of user-centered design. User at the center of the design process. So computer in the loop to me is more human-centric, where the goal is the user has a problem, has a need, and I want to be the computer that will help solve this problem. So I will design with respect to the user. And I think this is particularly important for tasks that are ill-defined. In human-computer interaction, I don't particularly, but many people use the word task all the time. And when you say task, again, other blinking lights saying, these people think that you can describe human activity as something that you read out of a book of recipe, and the user is going to do this, and the system is going to do that, and then the user is going to do this, etc. This is not the way it works. Tasks are something very artificially created. We'll talk, when we talk about theories, about Lucy Suchman's plans and situated action. And her point is that people never do what they're supposed to do, or asked to do, or learn to do. They adapt to the situation. Right? So what I call creative task here is not just the creative artist who's going to use Photoshop to do something, it's some painting. Many of the tasks we do today, from writing a program to, to deciding what music you want to listen to, all of these I call creative tasks, because they don't follow an algorithm, right? They depend on so many variables and so many things that the computer couldn't do it for us, but the computer can help us doing that. So I hope one of these days the computer in the loop thing is going to catch up and we'll start seeing it in the literature. Right now, you see a lot of human in the loop. You don't see computer in the loop.
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
I think even in the computer in the loop systems, there is some part where humans have to conform to human in the loop, right? Like, I mean, you might try to design it for humans completely, but like, it might not work out completely.
Well, of course, I mean, but I think that there's, you have to distinguish what the design process is and then what the actual outcome. So yes, in every computer, the best design system today, you still have to learn things, you still have to adapt to the computer. But the difference is when the system is also adaptable, when you can make it do things. To me, the criteria is this: if you can make the system do things that it was not designed to do in the first place, then this is an advantage. Now, can you think of this? Can you think of a system that you use in a ways that you don't think it was designed for?
Sometimes it might be useful as well. Sorry? I mean, sometimes you might design some systems the way it might not be used, but you figure out that it might be useful.
For example, I use Google to check my grammar about spelling. I use Google to check my spelling.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm writing okay a word, so I type it in Google.
I do that too, by the way.
You see, if 1 million people write,
yes.
Yeah.
20 million.
100 people write wrong. And a lot of people also use Google Mail to like store documents. Now we have Google Docs, but before that, we just send an email to ourselves or to remember tasks.
Right?
Yeah, so the technology might not be designed like for it, but still we use it.
Yes, but that's the point. But that's, to me, there's a sentence, a quote, and I don't know exactly where it comes from, that says, a good design is better than you think. Now, write this down. write this down. A good design is better than you think. And this is exactly what it means, is when your system is going to be used in ways you didn't think was possible. Which doesn't mean you don't want to pay attention to that, and then for version 2, take that into account, right? But that comes into the co-adaptation thing that I'll talk about. But an example I will come to in the historical part is the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet was created with the idea that, well, you know, if you're an accountant, adding all these columns and numbers is really painful. So why did the system could do it for you? And then Bricklin created VisiCalc. And sure enough, people used it to add columns and numbers. But what they started doing is things it was not designed for at all. And even nowadays, I don't think these kind of tasks are very well supported. Which is what-if experiments. I'm sure you used a spreadsheet this way. So, you know, if you're the same accountant and you're doing the budget, well, it used to be that you do one budget and that was it. With a spreadsheet, you say, oh, what if I add this here and I remove this there, and then automatically you see your balance. And so you can try different things. And if you look, I mean, spreadsheets are the canonical example of something that has been used in so many ways that it was not planned for, that it's just mind-boggling. People use it to do drawings, so you know, wire diagrams where each cell is people have done games in Excel. People through macros can automate tasks. So I think that shows that, you know, by not putting too much in the system in the beginning, you get a lot more than what you would have if you had designed something just to do budgets. I mean, accounting.
But as a developer, I think I mean, when the semantic of my product is lost, then I feel a little bit bad, like, about it.
Yeah?
I mean, like, I designed the product for a particular purpose. Sometimes I lose the meaning of it, then I feel a little bit bad, right?
Well, for every example, you can have a counterexample. So we'll get to examples of designs where, you know, sometimes you want the design to be open and sometimes you want it a lot more closed. So I need to move on because we'll never get to see the videos otherwise. So this is a diagram you'll see again and again in my classes. And it's what I call the conceptual model of an interactive system. And it's very simple. As I said, the system is a state. So the state is represented by objects, in generic sense. It doesn't have to be an object-oriented thing. It can be a database. And these objects have an API, a set of operations that it can do over those objects. So your objects are files. You can copy a file, rename a file, whatever. If your object is a structure of a text, the operations are to insert text, delete text, change the formatting, whatever. That's what I call the user interface. It's a set of commands. The user can specify commands. It can be typing something to the line interface. It can be clicking things on the screen. It can be speaking out a voice command. There are various ways to specify commands. Most of them take some time. The click is, well, for the machine, it's not instantaneous. In the user's head, the click is an event. But most commands take time. So while you input the command, you want some feedback. So the system tells you that you're doing what you think you're doing. If you didn't have feedback, you wouldn't see the characters you type when you enter something at a command line, which would be frustrating. If you didn't have feedback when you drag an object, you wouldn't see what you're dragging or where. So feedback is important because, the real world has feedback. So we want to provide feedback for the user here. Then at some point, the command is specified, and either you hit return, or you click, or you end your sentence, it gets turned into one or more operations that are applied to those hidden objects. And the result of these operations is what I call the response, and is also sent back to the user. So I drag the icon of the file to the trash, I drop it, it generates operation delete the file, and I get a response, I don't know, the file disappears, trash can get bigger, maybe there is a sound, or maybe there's nothing. Sometimes when nothing happens, it is feedback. It is a response, sorry. If I ask you what time it is and you don't answer, it's an answer. It's not, I don't have a watch, it's, I don't want to talk to you. Now, we will learn how to analyze existing systems. You'll do that during the TAs. Take an existing system, a browser, a mail reader. We won't do it for a whole application, but deconstruct it into, okay, what are the commands? What is the feedback? What are all these bits? And then you will learn to use it to design a system. How do I create the set of commands, feedback responses to design my system? The point about the conceptual model, and I'll talk about it more later, when we talk about theories and the action theory from Don Norman, is that if your conceptual model, the one that was in your head as a designer and that you've put into creating your system, matches the user's mental model, which is what the user will build in his head of representation of how your system works, if these two things match, then, user happy, right? Because it means that whatever assumptions you make about the system are going to be right. You know what are the commands, that if this and that command are available, and if this one is as well. So you can make prediction and learn the system. If the user's mental model does not match the conceptual model, then trouble. The thing is, I cannot download the mental model into the user's head with a USB key. Not yet. The mental model is built out of not only what the user sees of your system, but also what is used before, what his job is, a number of other things that are not under your control. Which is the reason why designing systems for a very wide audience is so much harder than designing a system for a very targeted audience. Because with a targeted audience, you can build on, you know, if they do a particular job, if they're a typographer, you can build on the vocabulary they use, on what we'll call metaphors of their work, and it will more likely create the right mental model. If you're doing an app on an iPhone for the whole world, you know, people will look at it and come with different mental models. So I will come back to this quite often because I think it works well in terms of separating the system into what is really the user interface, what input I put into the system, what output and feedback I get from the hidden part, which is objects and operations. And for any operation, you can have multiple commands triggering the same operation, but also the same command or a set of similar commands can trigger different operations, and so you have notions like homogeneity, having things that look like each other, and etc. So you can map a lot of the criteria that we will talk about that make a system better to this diagram. And now a word of warning. It's the paradox of HCI. And I mentioned it briefly on Monday. Making things simple is hard. Not only is it hard, but it's hard for people to understand that it is hard. Because when you come up with something that is simple, it means that you really understood the essence of it. It means you understood what could be left out. It means that you understand how people will use it. So it means you understand your user population. And then you put it in front of people and say, hey, of course, that's obvious. And they will not notice. They will not notice that there is an interface. So the goal of interaction is really invisibility, transparency. But because people don't notice, they don't say, good job, right? They only tell you when it's bad. Now, this is made even worse because we all use interactive systems. You and me and your parents and your friends and everybody around and people who know nothing about computers, have no interest in computers whatsoever except for solving their tasks. But because the only thing they see of the computer is this screen, this user interface, they think they know how it can be made better. Because they know what problems they run into and say, oh, it should do this, it should do that. Without realizing, of course, that it's a lot more complicated than it seems to solve problems. Some problems are obvious to fix, but the interesting ones are those that are not obvious. So I'll take a little example. It's about the notion of file. You know what a file is. Your parents know what a file is?
What
you said no.
Yeah, not in the sense I do know it. They think it's really like a physical object, but file is actually just a string of zeros and ones somewhere spread over my hard disk. So,
what do they know about saving?
Yeah, that's just the point. They think saving means to save the file, but actually you replacing it, overwriting it, putting it somewhere else. It's so much behind it. So I don't think they have the same concept of a file as I do. So I don't think they get what a file is actually.
Okay. What about applications? You know what an application is? I gave my mother an iMac in 98. It's right before I went to Denmark, which ended up costing me a lot of phone calls. And to this day, so it's been 15 years, every time she calls me because she has a problem, I tell her, "What application are you in?" She says, "What?" And I say, "Well, what does it say in the top left next to the Apple?" Finder. Oh yes, so you can't print, you have to click in the window you want to print or something. If you think of the notion of an application, I mean, are there applications in the real world? Where did this word come from in the first place? What does it mean, an application? I mean, I know an application when I apply to be a student at a master's program. That's an application, but it's not the same application. So, we'll see in a moment the Xerox Star, which didn't have applications. It had documents. That was it. So there are things we take for granted that may not be meaningful to everyone. And because people are embarrassed to not know about computers, they won't admit it. They won't even know they don't know.
In many applications, the icon for save is a diskette.
Disk. It's a floppy disk. Who can see a floppy disk? But yeah. But the thing about saving is we all know that you need to save, because until you save, the stuff can be lost. But we also know how to use that. So if I'm asked to write a letter of recommendation, I don't start from scratch. I take the last one I wrote, I open it, I start editing the name. I mean, I end up rewriting the whole letter sometimes. And then I save it under a different name. And I know that there's this whole in-between time where I'm editing something that is not really saved, even though it says the same file name at the top. And now Apple comes up with this new thing where you don't save anymore. It saves all the time. And I'm really struggling because I've lost letters of recommendation and other documents by starting typing without saving or doing what they call version or duplicating. And I really beat myself for it, because what they did is obviously the right model. You shouldn't have to save. Computers can save for you. But we are so wired to using save and use it in ways that it was not intended for, that it screws us up. And so one problem you get with the wide adoption of computers is that some practices that were here for historical reasons, maybe because of the power of computers or because the first computers with graphical user interfaces were used for office work, and so this notion of file comes from there. If they had started doing computers for something else, maybe it would be a totally different vocabulary. But the more people use it, the more it becomes widespread, and you can't change it. It's like the layout of the keyboard. We know we can do a keyboard that is faster, but you know, people are used to it. So people all use interactive systems. They have ideas how to improve them, but usually you shouldn't take their advice. And I say this because we'll talk a lot about user-centered design. You'll hear about participatory design, involving users in the design process. But that's a different thing from saying the user should be a designer. They can help, they can have ideas, they can have very good ideas, but you still have to be an HCI specialist to drive the design process. And the last thing on here is that adaptability of humans is a very good thing, and a very bad thing too for designers. because people adapt to things and get into what I would call bad habits that are very hard to undo. And sometimes you have, you know, new version of your system where you changed your conceptual model because you know it's going to work better, but all your installed base, all your existing users are going to go wild at you because you screwed them up. And you know, when you do, you know, I will say a lot of bad things about Microsoft Office and Excel and all that. It's you know, I think all HCI courses do that. But you also have to recognize that doing a word processor for billions of people, you know, it is a very different task, and changing things takes a lot of courage. So HCI is multidisciplinary, and it's really multidisciplinary. There is all the engineering bit. My colleagues don't like when I put computer into engineering because it's computer science. Well, you know the saying that if a science has a science in its name, it's not really a science. There is science in computer science. It's just that for the purpose of HCI, a lot of computer stuff is really the technology that we're interested in. So computer engineering, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, optics. I mean, if you look at all the devices, I'll show some examples that are out today, it takes a lot of different types of engineering to build interactive systems, to exploit the very rich bandwidth that humans have in terms of input and output. There's the whole world of natural sciences, starting with psychology, understanding behaviors of humans, to sociology when you go to groups, to physiology, and even anthropology, which is more the cultural aspects. And then there's a whole world that is around design, from industrial design, product design, to visual design, typography, even architecture. Now that you have, you know, interfaces and interactive systems that are in public spaces and interactive cities. In Finland, in Oulu, they have a lot of public displays in the street, and they do a lot of experiments there. I don't know if you know about that. So architecture, you know, how you design interactive buildings is a topic of interest. And so, you know, nobody can be knowledgeable in all these things. So if you go into creating interactive systems, you will have to work in multidisciplinary teams. And if you take the class on design of an interactive system that Wendy will teach, she'll talk about that a lot more. Okay, so I'll go quickly on this because we'll get back to it. So, design of interactive systems. The design of interactive systems, the important thing to know is that it has to be iterative. We don't know anything really about users. We know a bit about human psychology. We can learn a bit about users by observing them. But essentially, it's a trial and error process. So I observe users, it's the analysis part, I try to understand their needs. Then I prototype a solution. Then I create a functional prototype. Then I put it into the hands of the users, and then I see what they do with it. That's where I can start getting a sense of whether my conceptual model and their mental model, so it matches or not. And usually it's all wrong, and I go back to the drawing board, I do more observation, more design, more prototypes, etc. And the more times we'll go around this loop between release and N plus one, the more chances you have to do a good work. There is no magic bullet that will solve your problem. At least any interesting problem. And there is something that I think is extremely important here, the chaotic aspect. You know chaos, chaos theory, the butterfly and the tornado? Yes? Small causes, large effects. So my favorite version of the butterfly story in UI design is Microsoft. Microsoft Windows, up until maybe version 7, or I think they finally fixed it. So, you have used Windows? Yes? So you know that in Windows you can maximize a window, so it becomes full screen. In Windows they made the choice that the menu bar is at the top of the window, it's not at the top of the screen. On the Mac here, have you ever seen a Mac? I ask the question now because sometimes I'm surprising. So here the menu bar is at the top, even if my window is not full screen. On Windows, the menu bar is at the top of the window, so if my window is small, the menu is in the middle of the screen, and the argument is it's closer to where I'm working, if I'm working on a small window. If I maximize the window, the menu gets to the top. Well, not really. Have you noticed that between the menu bar and the top of the screen, there is a border? Yes? It's like 1-2 pixels. Okay, this makes pointing at every menu twice as slow. Why? Because if I'm here and I want to click on format, for example, what do? I throw my cursor? Because I know it's going to stop at the top. So what I call the target here is really the width of the word format, which is, you know, 4 or 5 times as wide as the height. If I'm in Windows and I do this and I click on the border. If I'm lucky, nothing happens. We'll see with Fitts' law, which is a law about predicting the time it takes to point, that this makes pointing on the menu bar where you take advantage of the border twice, at least twice as fast as if I were to point without hitting the border. It's 1 pixel, twice your menu selection time. Okay, it's not exactly the butterfly and the tornado, but I think this is not quite a good example either. So that's what I'm saying, you know, you can have the best conceptual model ever. If you don't go down to the very little detail of the pixel level, you can screw the whole thing up. And I think one thing that sets Apple apart from many other companies, especially big ones, is they do take attention to details of things that you would not otherwise think are important. They do a lot of things wrong as well, and I'll point out some examples. But it is what, in the end, will make the difference. If you have, you know, if you pay attention to detail, you will also pay attention to your users more, and so you will also improve your conceptual model part. So it's really part of the overall approach that shows up there. But remember this chaotic effect. And to finish this part, and we'll take a break, I want to talk about the 3 interaction paradigms. Computer as tool, computer as partner, computer as medium. Another way you will read about this is first person, second person, third person interfaces. Now imagine you want to find a book. Now, I'm talking a real book with real pages that you go into a real store to buy. I don't know if you're familiar with the experience. So how would you go about doing that? So you go to the bookstore. Well, you can go to the bookstore or the library. So let's say you go to the bookstore. What do you do?
I try trying to find the category I think my movie is about.
Okay, you're a first person person.
I ask to the
search the internet.
I think it depends.
No, there's no internet.
I think it depends on the name you have.
That's the person.
Yes, the person. You are a second person person.
That's good.
I don't know. Well, you guys are together, so it seems to work it out.
I like shopping, so it's nice to look.
Okay, so yeah. No, there's someone.
Yeah, for me it depends on the time you have. Maybe you, if you have more time, you try to look by yourself. If not, you ask the director to find the quick solution.
Excellent. So it depends. Sometimes I have time, I don't know what I'm really looking for exactly, so I like to look around. Sometimes I know what I want and I'm in a hurry and I want to ask the person. So there is this notion that sometimes we like to do things as, you know, ourselves, we like to be in control, and it can be because we know exactly what to do, how to do it, or because we don't know what we want at all, so it's interesting that it's both ends of the spectrum, but we like to use computers, if we translate that example into a computer, as a tool. You know, I have to master the tool to be able to carry out the task, and I want the tool to augment the user. So I will use tools to search on the net, but there are very few search tools, in fact, that help you to do what I call serendipitous search, when you don't know exactly where you're looking. You know, if you look in the general area of something, it's quite hard if you go from Amazon or Google or something else. But my course will focus on this notion of computers to augment user capabilities. I'm not saying it's better, because I really think that the other approach can be also better in certain circumstances. It's just that the work I do and my interest and my focus is on first-person interfaces. The computer as partner is a really powerful approach as well. The idea is you delegate tasks. Like, you know, I don't want to be bothered. Give me a book to read this weekend. You know my tastes. Just, you know, surprise me. Or, you know, I trust you to do exactly the thing I would do myself. So when you have an assistant, you know, very good assistants are good at second-guessing things, and you often don't even have to delegate tasks. They already understood they were going to do it for you. So that's what I expect of the computer. As I said before, the danger here is, well, if it works right, it's great. But, you know, if I delegate to a person and the person does a poor job, it gets complicated. So it can be very frustrating. This is also the area where a lot of artificial intelligence is taking place. Because a lot of it depends on the ability to learn the things you like or the way you do things, and to make things that are tailored to each user. So, you know, I think these two are very important, and I would like to see more systems where the two are combined, where I can, you know, start something myself and then say, well, finish it for me, or the other way around. Start doing something and then I'll do the details at the end, because that's why I want to focus on. There are very little work that does these hybrid interfaces that combine direct control by the user with more automation. And then there's a third thing that is really a third thing altogether, which is third-person interfaces, which is using computers to hook up humans together. So using the computer for a communication medium. Now this is something that has exploded in recent years with social media, you know, social networks, but also Skype and online systems. There is an area that is called crowdsourcing. Have you heard of crowdsourcing?
No. Yeah.
Yes? Good. So what is crowdsourcing? Yes?
In can you use the power of the crowd to, for example, solve tasks? So there are lots of examples, things that could be crowdsourced already. From I just did a crowdsourcing project.
For example, some enterprise use crowdfunding, and he got money from a lot of people publishing his idea in a social network, for example.
It's a use of the crowd for price. I guess it's to solve a problem, just to get money.
It's more likely a problem that is very hard for a computer to solve, which is very easy for a human to solve. So if you want to search for a cat, for example, a human couldn't figure out the difference between the dog and the cat. But if you give humans the means to label things and make it fun, for example, then you automatically create a crowdsourced environment.
Right.
For example, reCAPTCHA can be an example.
Right.
Well, no, CAPTCHA, the goal is that the computer...
No,
reCAPTCHA. Sorry.
It's when you enter a site and for...
verifying that you are a human.
He puts an image of a word that is like crossing.
And that's a crowdsourcing?
Because the word you are typing is, for example...
they use that to decipher old documents, for example?
Yes.
So they give you a snapshot of a piece of an old document and you have to...
Okay.
So instead of, you know, being computer generated, the input is...
I don't remember it very well. There was an experiment at MIT before many years about some balloons. Are you familiar with that?
Balloons?
They made an experiment and they sent all the labs in America to find a way to solve it.
Oh, yeah.
And to find some balloons around the city, and the lab that succeeded in that, I think it was a MIT, I'm not sure, they tell to some people to look some seconds in their web camera and see if they can see a balloon. So they make all the people cooperate.
Right.
I'm not sure if I
don't know the details either, but
it
rings a bell. So yeah, crowdsourcing is when you use, as you said, the power of the crowd, meaning a lot of human users doing a very small task to be able to solve a problem that the computer alone couldn't solve. So the early example was tagging photos. So you know, people were given two photos and they had to answer a very simple question. You could do a lot of these. Now, this is not really the computer as media, but it has this notion of integrating humans as part of a larger computation. And so, computer as media is really about exchanging messages, but if you push it a little bit, I think it's about having this more large distributed computations that include computer parts and human parts. And I think this is something quite intriguing. There are aspects that are, socially and morally maybe questionable. So Amazon is a service out there called Amazon Turk. Do you know the Mechanical Turk?
Yes.
I thought you were talking about that when you were talking about the blue thing. Isn't it the chess thing too? Chess player?
Well, so yes. So, the Mechanical Turk was an automaton that was created in, I don't know if it was like the 1700s. And it was a machine that was playing chess, and it was very good at it. But in fact, it was a fake, and there was a human inside the machine that was operating the machine. So it looked like an automaton, and it was a Turk with a turban, iron chest. It was very impressive, but it was a human inside. So the Mechanical Turk, this machine, has been used sort of as a metaphor for this crowdsourcing systems where try to solve a big problem with the computer, but in fact you have a lot of simple aspects, well, simple, not to the computer precisely, but a small task being dealt with by users. So Amazon has a service called Mechanical Turk, Amazon Mechanical Turk, MT, where you can put out a task and it gets outsourced to a number of, and they're called Turks. So human users, and then you get your answer. Now the thing is, to get this to work, you need to pay people. The problem is the micro tasks are paid like a cent, or a fraction of a cent sometimes. The problem is that you now have people in some areas, as I think it is in India in particular, who live off doing this kind of things, spend their days doing really very boring tasks. And so the thing is, as a metaphor, I mean, crowdsourcing, I think, is very interesting, but you also have to pay attention that it doesn't become a new kind of slavery.
There's a recent paper from MSR India on maybe using this to provide livelihoods to people. Like, maybe you could use, for example, people who are learning less than $1 a day, they could use the service, and then, like, probably they could live with it.
Yeah, I think this is a very big discussion that I would love to get into, it's interesting that people are starting to take this into account, and in fact, using that to also improve the skills of the workers, for example, can be an interesting way. Very interesting work to be done in this area. Anyway, so let's take a short break. I would like to keep it to 15 minutes, if that's okay with you. And so we'll start again at about 11.